Welcome to another edition of the New Hampshire Journal podcast presented by our friends at the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, where Drew Klein, you have been on a tear this week on the interwebs, my friend.
Thanks.
So I assume you'll be let off soon or you'll be canceled or something. They'll protest. You'll be banned. You and Dr. Seuss. Something will happen.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about Dr. Seuss. Jeff Jacoby's column this week is on the Harvard admissions policy and how they treat Asians and how they obviously discriminate against Asian Americans or Asians in general, because they basically say Asians don't have nice personalities. Right. So and it just got me to thinking that which is worse for Asians and Asian Americans, the drawing of the Chinese guy in Dr. Seuss's Mulberry Street book or Harvard's admission policy?
Well, obviously the book. I mean, you know,
obviously we have to cancel the book, but the Harvard admissions policy is okay.
No, because of
less damaging than
do you policy. Know anything about Harvard's politics? Of course it's okay. Whatever they do is okay. It becomes okay as soon as they do it. I understand why you say this. By the way, you talk about discrimination. We don't even discriminate against people who clearly have the vid listening to you talk on this podcast. Jeez, so what do you have, like COVID-27? What the heck?
You know, the funny thing is, because we've been distancing and with COVID and everything, nobody in our house has gotten sick in more than a year. And then my youngest son got a tiny, tiny, tiny cold, just the sniffles, nothing bad. And then I caught it from him. But that's all we've had. So it's not too bad.
Well, I have had a dental emergency. That's what's happened to me. But fortunately, Dr. Bruce Houghton at Perfect Smiles is taking care of me. I'm going to be zipping in. He fit me in quickly, but I had a tooth that broke. And what's weird is it broke vertically. So like, you know how in the Antarctic, like an ice shelf will just kind of fall off. So like a front, so it's really weird. But anyway, that's why, and I'll be talking more about Dr. Bruce at perfectsmiles.com because they are sponsoring this podcast. And I don't know that they're getting any of the COVID money, but when you're throwing out $2 trillion, it's hard to miss it. Isn't it, Drew Klein?
You know, Ben Sasse had the best comment on this, that this package is larger than the GDP of Canada. So we could have just bought Canada.
Yeah, but then we're stuck with it. And who wants it? You know, I
mean, we do what you do when you buy, you buy Canada and you strip it of all the good stuff and then you resell it for more money.
So you
take the syrup, you know, we take the maple syrup.
And the hockey and the poutine.
And then we sell the rest.
Okay. And see what you can get with, vast tracts of wasteland, obnoxious liberals and whale blubber and socialized medicine. So not a lot to go.
But, you know, it's about the same as the GDP of Italy. We could have bought Italy.
Ah, now you're talking. But this is what frustrates me. Nobody's talking about the math. There's a hilarious Washington Post headline this week. Biden showers money on the American people as part of a poverty program. And I'm like, what shower money, poverty program? I thought we had a COVID emergency and that we had to take actions because of the desperate straits of the economy. And just this week, unemployment numbers came out. Unemployment is declining. It has plunged from 15% in April or May to about 6%-ish nationwide now. We were told the states were all going to go broke because of lack of revenue. More than 30 states have either seen more revenue or kept their revenue the same. And a handful of states have had record revenue. In fact, this past week, Drew Klein, Governor Sununu sent a letter to the legislature going, we are so over our projected revenue, I want you to stick some spending back in.
Yep. So New Hampshire is, first of all, nationwide, most states did not see this sort of horrible impact from 2020 that we thought we were going to have. Mm-hmm. So once the lockdowns were lifted around midsummer to late summer, the economy started to bounce back by and large. You had some states did very badly, but on the whole, the economies have bounced back. And New Hampshire's has bounced back very strongly, as the Josiah Bartlett Center pointed out in a report we released last week that we talked about on the podcast. And as a result, since August, state revenues in New Hampshire have exceeded budget. So we now have a $103 million budget surplus for this year. $100 million budget surplus. So it looks like we are on track to have no deficit at all by the end of the year and more money. So the governor went back and said, based on our changes in revenue, we're going to ask for $70 million to be put back in the budget that we didn't think we would have to spend. So things are actually going pretty well. And economically, the idea that we need to spend the GDP of Italy, astounding, right? To get the economy moving again is obviously wrong. The economy is moving. We don't need this level of bailout. You could have done a package for, say, between $100 billion and $400 billion, right? Depending on what sort of aid you were looking at and how you targeted that aid based on poverty or income and so forth. You could have done a relatively speaking small package and actually delivered just aid to needy people or needy businesses. And it wouldn't have been really controversial. People would have understood. Instead, we're spending the GDP of Italy on a bunch of programs that aren't targeted towards pandemic relief. It's a bait and switch. It's entirely unnecessary. And it's shocking that it would even, that something like this would pass. Not surprising at all, but extremely disappointing.
I don't know, when you're promising people free money, you're in a pretty good spot politically. And that's what, for most people who are just watching the headlines and TV news, all they hear is $1,400 check. And so a lot of people are going to get, quote, free money, $1,400 or $2,800. And this is going to come in their mailbox and they're going to get it and they're going to be happy. And all the other rest, the idea of paying it back or the impact on the national debt, having having our debt exceed our GDP, which is very rare. We have the highest debt we have ever had excluding the spending on World War II. Is that really an issue from a public policy standpoint, Drew Klein, that people care about? Or is one of those things that if you ask them on a poll, do you want to have deficit spending? No, no, no. And then you say, well, do you want to give up your money? They say, well, no, no, no. Send me my $1,400 check.
Well, it should be something people care about. And part of the problem here is obviously the media coverage. So when the media coverage is, ooh, look at all the government, all the free money that the government is giving. Look at the benefits. Look at how this will help people. Well, that's the tone of the coverage. Mm-hmm. Then people aren't going to get so alarmed. If the coverage were more fair and took a more data-centric approach and said, okay, this is going to be the cost. This is the long-term cost. And let's break down what percentage of this package goes to COVID relief and what percentage goes to other things that aren't related to COVID relief. And let's get into the numbers. And then let's talk about how we're going to have to raise taxes to pay this back or cut spending in other programs. You would have different levels of acceptance. So I think the media coverage is a big part of the problem and always has been when it comes to government spending. But when you look at, one of the things I read about this package is, it's about 9% of 2020 US GDP. We're spending 9% of 1 year's worth of our GDP. And it's just when we don't need to, when the economy is rebounding and coming back.
How can you possibly say that when we need that $128 billion to get public schools reopened, even though every public school system in New Hampshire is either reopening or is on track to reopen, and around the country schools are already reopening, and only $9 billion of that $129 billion will be spent this year? How can you say that, Drew Klein? It's obviously an emergency. That's why we have to hold the money to spend it in 2028.
Yeah, one of the things that's been disappointing, again, in some of the media coverage is the way they've covered school reopening. And to the New York Times' credit, they recently did a couple of stories on reopenings, and they interviewed a bunch of physicians and healthcare professionals, and universal across the board agreement that schools not only can reopen safely, but should have already reopened safely. And they quoted, we wrote about this at the Josiah Bartlett Center this week. You could get it in our newsletter. If you want to go to jbartlett.org and see what we wrote, where they quoted a bunch of professors of medicine attacking teachers' unions for keeping schools closed when there was no scientific reason to do so. Again, it's one of those things where the data and the numbers are on the side of reopening, are on the side of not needing to spend the vast amount of funds that Congress wants to spend. And yet, it just that doesn't seem to get through, because the politicians claiming otherwise soak up so much media attention and aren't really challenged on it.
And ladies and gentlemen, what you've just heard is what's known as Neanderthal thinking. only Neanderthals do math. Don't you know that, Drew Klein? Only Neanderthals point out that the same school system in New Hampshire is going to be reopened by March 8th with or without the COVID relief bill, and yet we're spending the money. And interestingly, Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire made some headlines when she got the Senate to agree to an amendment to the COVID spending package that said every school that accepts the COVID money must present a plan to reopen.
And that's definitely splitting the baby there. I mean, look, I think that's good. It's better than not having an agreement to reopen. However, you don't need to have a plan to reopen. You should reopen. And you should, in other words,
wait. You mean that other amendment that was offered that said every school that should take the money has to agree to reopen, that both Senator Hassan and Senator Shaheen voted against? You'd have gone that way, the take the money and then reopen plan?
Right, because I mean, anybody in politics knows a plan is just something written on paper. It doesn't mean you're actually going to do it. Government shelves are full of binders full of plans that have never been used and are never going to go.
I'm microaggressed from you saying that.
Yes. So it's better than not having it. Mm-hmm. So good for her for that. But she should have voted for if you have the money, if you get the money, you need to go ahead.
But what she did vote.
Honestly, they should already have plans to reopen. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be creating a reopening plan in March and April of 2021. That's a massive dereliction of your duty as a superintendent or a school board if you don't already have a reopening plan.
Well, much like paying back this $1.9 trillion, that's a problem for another day, and we will worry about the damage we've done to our children and the year that they've lost and the disproportionate impact it's had on low-income and minority children and the way kids who are already struggling in places like Nashua and Manchester have now lost another year compared to their counterparts in places like Bedford and Amherst. But that, once again, that's for another day. Let's talk about where we are right now, the fact that both New Hampshire U.S. senators joined six of their Democratic colleagues to vote to take out the $15 minimum wage mandate. And I want to talk about the economics in just a second, Drew Klein. But before you do the economics, let me share with you the politics. There were progressives in New Hampshire who were very angry. Lots of talk of how Senators Shaheen and Hassan need to be primaried. State Representative Eric Gallagher of Concord tweeted out, "They aren't moderates, they're right-wing conservatives who need to be primaried from the left." I don't know a lot of people who consider Senators Hassan and Shaheen right-wing conservatives, but I think I was most impressed by Representative Sherry Frost, who's from Dover and Durham and that part of the state, who was inspired, I think, because of the Dr. Seuss controversy, to poetry. And so she tweeted a poem in response to the senators' votes, and you can find it at nhjournal.com as part of our coverage. "The message my senators sent was that low-wage workers get bent. But how to survive, to say nothing of thrive, when you can't even cover the rent?" So there you go, political protest poetry.
I think she should be at the next inauguration. Next time a Democrat's inaugurated for governor, they should have a Sherry Frost poem.
That would be excellent.
It'd be beautiful. But, the Josiah Bartlett Center actually issued a statement praising Hassan and Shaheen for this vote, because this is something that I think is lost on a lot of political activists. But your U.S. senators do not represent you as an activist for your party. They don't represent their party. They represent their states. And a $15 minimum wage was obviously, plainly, and incontrovertibly bad for New Hampshire, because we have lots of occupations and lots of businesses that pay less than $15 an hour because they can't afford to pay more than that. So the average wage in New Hampshire, when you combine all occupations, management, lawyers, everybody, is last year was about $26 an hour. But the average wage in food prep and serving related occupations in New Hampshire last year was $13.45 an hour. So very few people make the minimum wage of $7.25. In fact, one of the businesses that paid the minimum wage because it could not afford to pay more just went out of business last week. That's Cinemagic Theaters. They paid last year when they were open, they paid minimum wage to starting entry-level employees. Because they couldn't afford it otherwise, and they're now out of business. So it just shows you sort of who pays the minimum wage and why. It's not big thriving companies. It's often small businesses, and it's often entry level wages. Some big thriving companies do pay minimum wage, but they pay it for entry level, low skill employment. It's the first rung on the ladder. So the average wage for food prep and serving occupations in New Hampshire is $13.45, which means half of those are below that. Right? A bunch of places pay below $13 an hour. So if you're a small business in Littleton or Conway, Conway is one of the regions in New Hampshire that has the lowest average wages. A $15 minimum for your restaurant or your little boutique shop along the tourist strip is going to put you out of business. And so good for them for voting against it. And I hope it doesn't come back.
So as you know, there's a movement among some restaurant workers in New Hampshire to push back against the attempt to raise the minimum tipped wage. Because as they say, they don't want to earn just $15 an hour. Because plenty of people in the service industry, particularly waiters at nice restaurants and other high-end places, ski lodges, et cetera, that they make well more than that. So they don't want it. I thought it was interesting, though, you mentioned about the small businesses who can't afford it. During the debate in front of the House Labor Committee a few weeks ago about mandatory sick leave, Representative Michael Cahill of Newmarket said that if you're a small business who can't afford to pay sick leave, maybe you should just not be in business. And that's an argument I've heard quite a bit about the minimum wage, that if you can't afford to pay $15 to your employees, then you just shouldn't be open. You should just shut down. And from an economic standpoint, what does that, does that make sense?
No, of course it doesn't make any sense. And it's a fallacy. One of the ways to think about wages, the purpose of a wage is not to feed a family of four or a family of six or a family of two. That's not the point of the wage. The point of the wage is to give somebody something of value in exchange for work that they do. And wages, like other prices, are set by the market, and they're determined by, what each side gets. So when you are mopping floors at McDonald's, and by the way, my wife and I watched the original Coming to America last night. For those of you who haven't seen it, you really need to. And, the prince takes a job mopping floors at a fast food restaurant. That is a low skill, entry level job. What it does is it gives you the opportunity to start work, to build skills, to make those connections, and to learn work habits and work ethic, and then move your way up. And that's how it's actually used by most people who have those jobs. Why you would expect or put the burden on all employers to provide a full living for every single person who has any job, as if teenagers don't work, right? As if people who don't have families of four are not employed in these jobs. It's just a fallacy. I don't know where that thinking comes from. It's a massive lack of understanding of how jobs and the economy and prices actually function in our society.
There's another part of the vote for the COVID package that I'm just kind of surprised hasn't gotten more attention. And just a reminder, all four members of the New Hampshire delegation voted for the final version. And while the final version did not include the $15 minimum wage, while the final version lowered the weekly unemployment federal add-on from $400 to $300 a week. And there are a lot of economists, as you know, Drew, who say that's a drag on the economy because it keeps productive workers out of work because they're like, well, what the heck? Why not stay home? Man, it's awfully easy to stay home. But there's some other things that are in the bill that just really surprised me that they haven't gotten any attention. And I'm going to share them with you in a second. But first, I want to share, as I was just saying earlier, I had a little dental emergency. I had no problem about who I called, Dr. Bruce Houghton at perfectsmiles.com, who wants me to remind you, don't wait for an emergency. They get very annoyed when I talk about the times that I or my wife or someone I know needs to rush in because they don't want to be doing, all the emergency dentistry at 4 a.m. They want you to keep your, smile nice and healthy. If you don't like your smile, they do a magnificent Perfect Smiles program to give you the smile you've always wanted. Absolutely terrific. And at this time where people have COVID worries, they have really got the health and safety part locked down. Talk to Stephanie Houghton, Dr. Bruce's boss, aka wife, and also runs the office. Not a single COVID case traced back to Perfect Smiles. And she said, I want to brag, but actually the dental industry has done a really good job because they know what the problem is. They're smart. They worry about their patients. And so they've figured out the technology to make sure that you don't have to let your dental health suffer during the COVID crisis. So if you've been worried, afraid, or maybe you just have been really unhappy with the care you've gotten from your current dentist, and you want a dentist who cares about you, who's involved in your life and your overall health, I've known Dr. Bruce Houghton for years. Love him. He's right there in Nashua. Just go to the website, perfectsmiles.com, and please tell them Michael Graham sent you. So is it safe to say, Drew Klein, that government workers suffer a bit from a marketing standpoint, that they're not the most popular segment of the American economy? Do you think that's a fair statement?
Well, it depends on what government job you're doing. So if you're a police officer or a teacher,
good point.
Then you are very highly valued. You know, if you are a DMV employee, you probably have a lower reputation.
Well, you know the phrase good enough for government work, right? Well, the COVID package, if you're a federal bureaucrat, it's not good enough. It is great because buried about halfway through the 628-page COVID final product is a $527 million program, a $500 million program for just one thing. Federal workers who have to stay home to care for their kids, and it can be for any reason, including the kids are doing hybrid education, so you need to sit in the house while they Zoom call their teacher. Whatever the cause is, you can collect $1,400 a week. A week. Up to $21,000 in the I had to sit at home and watch my kids do homework plan. I thought for sure the Democrats would strip this out because it's number one, it's so unrelated to COVID. And number two, it's $500 million. And number three, it goes to the employees of the federal Department of Federalism. But no, it's still there. And the average taxpayer can't get it, but federal government workers can.
You know, whenever there is a vote on an energy bill, for example, you will see stories in Politico and the Washington Post and the New York Times and explicitly left-wing outlets that says, oh, well, you know, these Republican senators voted for this big oil bill and big oil gave X number of dollars to them. That, right. You will always see that.
Absolutely.
You will never see, rarely, I should say, see the converse, which is massive unjustified payoffs to government employees and that tied to the government employee union donations to Democratic Party members. So if you were to look at the various government employee unions that benefited from something like this and then see where their donations went, you know, you could make a correlation there, but the press will never do that. That's for some reason.
And let me mention one more group of people in the state revenue stream. I don't know that I call them government employees, but they do often work in the Department of Rock Breaking and License Plate Art. And that is our federal and state prisoners. There was an amendment offered to prohibit them. This is people who are, this isn't ex-cons. This isn't people with a record. This is, you are literally sitting in the cell, you know, clanging on the bars with your platter from getting the stimulus checks. And the Democratic majority voted it down. They blocked it. So if you are incarcerated at the NHDOC as a federal or state prisoner, you will be getting your $1,400 check from the taxpayers, about $2 billion in total spending. And once again, to come back to, from a stimulus standpoint, if that's the premise, right? You want to stimulate. How does spending $2 billion to the prison commissary for smokes and tattoo ink, you know, bolster the economy?
That's just stunning. I guess, you know, Altria and the cigarette companies are probably liking this and, you know, good for them. But wow. Again, there's just no justification for that whatsoever. It's not stimulating the economy. But the $1,400 in general is not justified.
Right. Good point. Good,
you know,
point.
For everybody, it's not justified. I mean, when you look at, again, the economy coming back and the number of people who've gone back to work and the relatively speaking, the smaller impact that COVID lockdowns had on the economy than was anticipated, the size of this package is just entirely unjustified.
I want to ask you about a debate that was happening this week before we wrap up here, involving Governor Sununu and the members of the delegation who are Democrats, obviously a cross-party fight there. But, you know, Sununu was arguing we're getting less. The size of the spending went up 120% when it comes to state and local aid. But New Hampshire's slice only went up 20%. And in part, it's because of a formula that said states that have had, you know, more difficulty with unemployment, et cetera, are going to get a larger share. And Sununu's argument is, hey, we opened up more quickly. We found ways to make it work. We manage better. Why are we getting less in these states that are suffering? Whereas Democrats in New Hampshire argued, you know, the whole point of aid is to help the people who need it. And, you know, it's like saying, why are you sending federal flood money to Texas during a flood? You know, my state's not flooded and we're not getting it. From a policy standpoint, Drew Klein, I think the Democrats have a point, even though from a political standpoint, I think Sununu probably wins that argument.
Look, let's state in general, aid for people who have suffered should go to people who have suffered.
Right.
Right. However, I think Sununu is correct that New Hampshire is kind of getting shafted in this because we have done so well. And so it is the case that, you know, the bulk of this is going to places that struggled and that whose governments were inept. And so part of this, again, if you're looking, you could look at this package in a lot of different ways, right? Should it be stimulus? That's one thing. Should it be aid? That's a different thing than stimulus. So what's the goal? And they've thrown in a whole bunch of different goals, and the goals are all mixed and confused. And they don't know that the package is trying to be everything to everybody, plus just giving away a bunch of money to favored groups, which is terrible. But if you were going to do either of those, aid or stimulus, you should target it wisely. And it just doesn't look like this bill is structured in mm-hmm. such a way as to be targeted
right.
in a, wisely to help. It is, I think Sununu is onto something here with the idea that it's structured in such a way as to give outsized payouts to states with inept bureaucracies and poorly functioning governments that screwed up, and states that did a good job, like Vermont and New Hampshire and a couple others that are not all red,
right.
You know, are getting less aid than they might otherwise. Now, you could argue they don't need it, but they're getting less. But again, it's not all aid.
See, yeah, that's why I think you just revealed the weakness of the Democrats' argument, which is if the money were being handed out, for example, to the hospitality industry, and it happened to go disproportionately to places like Las Vegas and Florida and northern New Hampshire, no one would complain because you go, well, yeah, I get it. That's specifically who's suffering, but they're not. They're just handing out money willy-nilly, and somehow the willy is bigger in California than the nilly is in New Hampshire. I think that's it. Before I let you go, I got to ask about a great piece that you have at the Josiah Bartlett website, jbartlett.org, which we are, by the way, stealing and republishing at New Hampshire Journal, about the debate over energy policy in New Hampshire and the anger over the last coal-fired plant in the Granite State.
Yeah, so for those of you who didn't follow, recently the, I won't get all the details, but basically Merrimack Station in Bow, which is the last coal-fired power plant in New Hampshire, and one of the last in New England, it got another lifeline for two more years, but because of the way that the energy grid works, it's going to be operating. It's gotten these payments, a contract to receive payments to stay open as a default backup energy source. And of course, there's some radical Greens who are, you know, incensed by this. And NHPR, in its story, wrote, and I just found this, you know, amusing. New Hampshire's coal-fired power plant, the last of its kind in New England, not set to retire, will remain online, et cetera, despite calls from climate change activists for it to close. As if climate change activists protesting, literally a handful of them, you know, I think it was fewer than 20 who came out and did that coal protest and broke into the plant. So they protest, and we're just supposed to say, okay, you win. You complain, so your position is wise by default. and there's no justification for keeping the coal plant open. It's a ludicrous position. And so we wrote about why is Merrimack Station still open? What purpose does it serve? And our, you know, to summarize, you should go read the piece because it gets into more detail. But we argue essentially it should be closed. Coal should have been phased out by now. We shouldn't be using anymore. But because of various factors, including environmental activists shutting off natural gas pipelines, it is now in northern New England, even though natural gas and petroleum products through fracking have largely eliminated coal, all but eliminated coal, there's still a use for a coal-fired power plant. And when you do the calculation of the benefit versus the cost, you are literally talking of a couple of days a year, a handful of days in the winter and in August to run this plant, would increase higher emissions for those few days. But that's the cost, but what's the benefit? And they never look at that. The benefit is we don't have blackouts because we have a reliable source of power. So people don't die and don't freeze to death in February and January, thanks to the Bow power plant. That's the benefit. And so you have to look at both of them. And when you weigh both, ideally, we wouldn't be using any coal right now. But as a transition between now and the time when we can use other sources that are reliable and efficient, coal, it makes sense. And so we just use that piece to try to, you know, push back against the narrative that because climate change activists complain, we should therefore just shut down all the coal plants.
I find it hilarious that you think that brownouts and blackouts are a bug as opposed to a feature, because, you know, first of all, when there's no power, you're not emitting. So that's a win right there. That's one of the reasons why, as an environmental activist said a few months ago, the COVID lockdown is, you know, got us 2% of what we need to achieve. So we need to do 50 COVID lockdowns in order to, you know, to.
Right. Well, you remember back, this was one of the great things that, exposed the sort of radical environmental movement for what it is back when the lockdowns happened. And you could see the pictures with no cars and the air was clean in these cities. And they said, look, this is great. Why can't we do this? So they're basically admitting in order to achieve our goals, we have to shut down the entire economy. And that is, in fact, what they want.
Look, nuclear and natural gas, you know, nice, easy, makes sense, far fewer emissions. And you never have to worry about them freezing. Well, that's, with natural gas, we found out in Texas you do. But if you plan ahead for the New Hampshire weather, you don't have to worry about it, them freezing. But, of course, they're not going to happen because it's not about emissions. It's about lifestyle. And in a future episode, we're going to talk about this move towards not aggregate power purchasing, which is kind of Costco power buying, where you get a whole town together and they say, hey, let's all buy together. That's fine. That's just a price thing. But community operation of power, including two-way thermostats that don't just allow your thermostat to send out a signal, hey, this is how much power I used. They let it send in a signal, hey, you're using too much. Let's turn that down a few degrees. So that's all. Another reason to keep listening to the New Hampshire Journal podcast, brought to you by the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. And then once again, where do we find your stuff?
It's on jbartlett.org, and you can go there and sign up for our weekly email newsletter. We get it every Friday. It's pretty short and to the point, unlike me babbling. And you can get that there. So go there. And next week we should talk about that, and we'll talk about my plan for a nuclear submarine in every neighborhood.
That'd be absolutely fantastic. But you also have another special guest visitor Zoom thingy coming up, right?
Yeah, we do. So you can go to jbartlett.org, and on our site you will see that we're having a couple more events coming up. We have Virginia Postrell. She is an author, great author, and former editor of Reason Magazine. She's coming up soon, March 23rd. Excellent. And then we have Grover Norquist in April. So go sign up for those.
And many of the stories you heard us talking about, you can find at nhjournal.com. We do a daily newsletter. Please sign up for it. And since the state has an extra $100 million, you know, Governor Sununu, advertising on New Hampshire Journal is a great way to invest those state dollars. Get the word out to the people who need to know about what New Hampshire is up to. And you can reach us anytime. Just email newsnhj at insidesources.com. That's newsnhj at insidesources.com. He's Drew Klein of the Josiah Bartlett Center. Thank you again to Dr. Bruce Houghton at perfectsmiles.com for being our sponsor. I'm Michael Graham at New Hampshire Journal.